6 days later, Jesus took with him Peter and James and his brother John and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became dazzling white. Suddenly there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. Then Peter said to Jesus, "Lord, it is good for us to be here. If you wish, I will make three dwellings here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." While he was still speaking, suddenly a bright cloud overshadowed them. And from the cloud a voice said, "This is my son, the beloved. With him I am well pleased. Listen to him." When the disciples heard this, they fell to the ground and were overcome with fear. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, "Get up and do not be afraid." And when they looked up, they saw no one except Jesus himself alone. As they were coming down the mountain, Jesus ordered them, "Tell no one about the vision until after the Son of Man has been raised from the dead." And the disciples asked him, "Why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first?" He replied, "Elijah is indeed coming and will restore all things. But I tell you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but they did to him whatever they pleased. So also, the Son of Man is about to suffer at their hands." And the disciples understood he was talking to them about John the Baptist. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Well, I warned some of you about the weather. You thought spring was here already. I told you it was a scam. We've been tricked into seeing something that hasn't happened yet. Kind of a theme for this text and for the sermon. And it reminds me of a really bad church joke. Did you ever hear about the kid who keeps misunderstanding all the Bible stories? Little Joey means well. He shows up every week, but he keeps getting the stories mixed up. The teachers keep asking him questions, but he keeps getting the answers wrong. He says things like, "Well, God got tired of making the world, so he took the Sabbath off." Or, "Adam and Eve were created from an apple tree." Or, "Noah's wife was called Joan of Arc." Or, "Lot's wife was a pillar of salt by day and a ball of fire by night." So one day the topic is Easter. The question is, who knows what Easter is? Little Joey shoots up his hand. The teacher groans, "Yes, Joey." And Joey said, "Easter's the day when Jesus wakes up again." And the teacher said, "That's pretty good. Tell me some more." "Yes," he said, "Easter is the day when Jesus wakes up again. He comes from a hole out of the ground. Then he sees his shadow, and we have 6 more weeks of Lent." Now, the timing for us couldn't be more appropriate. Not just because of the weather, but because the season of Lent is almost here. It comes this Wednesday, Ash Wednesday. It lasts until Jesus comes out of the grave, and who wants any more Lent than we have to already endure? Lent is 6 weeks of self-denial, 6 weeks of reflection on suffering, 6 weeks of hearing about the cross. Who wants 6 more weeks of that? Yet it appears that Jesus knows already in this story about self-denial, suffering, and the cross. He knows they're going to come. He doesn't run away when he knows that. He does not turn aside. The Gospel of Matthew says he knew all of that was coming on the day when he was transfigured. Now that is an odd truth about a very odd moment. There's nothing ever like the transfiguration, whatever that was. Jesus takes his inner circle, Peter, James, and John. They hike up a high mountain. Suddenly Jesus begins to shine. And it isn't the glistening perspiration on his brow either. He really begins to shine like the sun, like a flare, like something they had never seen before. It's such a strange moment that the gospel writers have to invent a word for it, the word transfiguration. Did Jesus suddenly become a solar flare? Or was he always like that, but disguised? Matthew doesn't know. I don't know. Who knows? In one of her poems, Madeline L'Engle writes, "Suddenly they saw him the way he was, the way he always was. Yet he was veiled in flesh and disguised. Still had splinters in his fingers from the wood shop." Others would say, no, it's not quite like that. Rather, Jesus was doing the work of God. He was healing people and teaching people and helping people. And in the momentary pause, God honored him. God rested on him or in him or something like that. You have to agree, it's a moment that defies explanation. And when it was over, just like that, who could describe what that was? Now the artists and the poets and the musicians can try. They labor at their crafts for years and years for that moment, that flash. The painter picks up the brush, dabs the colors, tries to touch the beauty before it slips away. The poet bounces rubber words against the wall until a metaphor is shaped and scratches it down on paper before it disappears. The musician breathes the scales, playing them up and down four octaves so that when the right moment comes, they can play the right note in the right way. And then the note evaporates like perfume, leaving behind a trace of transcendence, and it's gone. People with imagination know exactly what this transfiguration is. It's the aha moment, the moment when the sun slices through the clouds, the moment of deep insight or profound awakening. And even if you think you can capture it, like Simon Peter wanting to build his little monument, you never quite are able to do it. Like the man who runs up to Louis Armstrong after he blew some hot notes. He says, "Mr. Armstrong, was that music recorded?" And Pops looked at him and said, "It was only recorded on your heart, baby." So Peter, James, and John are there for the moment, for the solar flare moment, for the sunburst on earth moment. And Moses is there too. He'll even seem to care. There he is, time and space don't matter in a moment like that. And the great prophet Elijah is there too, but no one is asking him for a new sermon. All that matters is that they're all there. They're there. And then it's gone. Now, the most surprising thing for me as I hear the story this time is what Jesus says when the whole thing's over. Don't tell anybody what you see. Keep silent for a while. Guard the vision in your heart. Don't give it away quite yet. But don't tell anybody. Doesn't he remember that every vision either is explained away by the rational mind, or it just evaporates after the while. Doesn't he remember that aha moments slip away, that the burst of insight gets rusty, that ecstatic events diminish in a half-life? But he says, keep mum until my resurrection. Well, what's a resurrection? He hasn't even mentioned it, but only once in passing so far in this text, and he doesn't explain how that will happen either, or what it is, or what it looks like. Yet it seems that that is the key for grasping what we have just seen in this vision. When Jesus catches fire, it's a glimpse of what they're going to see later on. That there's a moment ahead when they will see the fullness of his glory, when everybody everywhere will see the fullness of his glory. They'll perceive he's the one who really was before all things, and he's the one who gets to finish everything off. And then when the gazillion watt spotlight goes off and they see plain old Jesus again, when they hear his unamplified voice, when they feel his familiar tap on the shoulders, when they hear him say, don't be afraid, they have the invitation then to believe it. I think that's the key. You know, I used to think that this story was kind of a fantasy, a slice of science fiction tossed back into a 2,000-year-old book. But I think now it's so much bigger than that. Because at very least, Matthew, in his first century way, is trying to point to the truth about Jesus, that he's both human and divine, a mystery it will take another 350 years in the church to get some of the language together to talk about. But even then, that language will only point. No creed or confession captures the truth of Christ. It's bigger than human words. Suffice it to say it this way. I think this is my creed today. Jesus is more than we thought he was, and he's just like us. That's a pretty good Christological statement. But there's a helpful word in this for us too. Don't tell anybody about this vision until after the resurrection. What are you saying to us, Lord? He goes on to say, I'm going to suffer. The Son of Man will suffer. He knows that. He says that, but he is not afraid of that because he knows there is something more to life than suffering. How else could he come down from that fiery mountain to carry a cross? How else could he knowingly or willingly face rejection by his own neighbors? How else could he continue his work unless he has the clear sense that there is something more? There's something more than pain. There's something more than illness. There's something more than lingering sadness. There's something more than hostility. There's something more than division. There's something more than suffering. There's something more than death. There's something more than the heavy cloud of grief. There's something more than darkness and confusion, even if we're not sure what it is. There's something more. Picture, if you will, the clarinetist I saw at Preservation Hall. I didn't think he was going to make it. He wobbled in there, he sat in a wicker chair, fiddling with his reed. The drummer announces the tune, begins to count it off. This ancient, withered man sits completely still and closes his eyes. The melody starts, and then he plays. Oh, did he play? And when he blew a solo, he began to stand and sway and dance. I never thought I'd see anything like it. He was so completely alive. When the music was over, he was back in the wicker chair, eyes closed, completely still. He looked 140 years old. The set was over, the Bourbon Street tourists are being ushered out. I needed to say something to him. I didn't know what to say. His eyes looked like thin slits. He began to dismantle his horn. I pushed forward to say, "Thank you." The thin slits opened a little wider, the irises connected, and he said, "I play every time like it's my last." Where did he get that passion, that energy, that excitement? I think we know. In her Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Gilead, a very good snow day read, by the way, Marilynne Robinson tells of old Reverend Ames. Near the end of his hard and complicated life as a preacher in Iowa, Reverend John Ames writes a letter to his young son. At one moment, he writes, "It seemed to me sometimes as though the Lord breathes on this poor gray ember of creation and it turns to radiance for a moment or a year or the span of a life. And then it sinks back into itself again, and to look at it, no one would know it had anything to do with fire or light. I've reflected on that. Because the Lord is more constant and far more extravagant than it seems to imply. Wherever you turn your eyes, the world can shine like transfiguration. You don't have to bring a thing to it except a little willingness to see. Only, who would have the courage to see it?" Now, if that's too metaphorical and leaves you in the dust, he goes on to say this. "There are a thousand reasons to live this life, every one of them sufficient. If only we knew. If only we knew in moments of suffering what we see also in the glory of Christ. If only we knew that when times are difficult, there is something more, so much more. If only we had the courage to see the glory and trust that it's there. If only we knew the day is coming when through the love of Jesus, every last one of us will be bright, shining like the sun."